I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. on Monday, May 4th, 2026. Present today, we have Representative Snapp, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Josephson, and myself, Co-Chair Schrage. As a reminder to members, if you could please mute your cell phones, I'd be grateful. Do the same thing here. I'd also like to take a quick moment to thank our committee support staff, including committee assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah Stufka, secretaries Bree Wiley and Leah Frazier, and our LIO moderator, Emily Mesh. Thank you. All right. With that, today we will be adopting the House Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 214, the capital budget. And then we will also, assuming we have time, move on to two other bills scheduled, SJR 29, Constitutional Amendment Education Funding, and SB 86, Money Transmission Virtual Currency. And I see a third bill listed here actually as well, HB 261, Education Funding, although I thought that was removed from the schedule. Brief at ease. All right, back on the record. Yes, I do believe we'll be bringing up HB 261 under bills previously heard and scheduled. All right, with that, Co-Chair Josephson, do I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute?
Yes, I move that the House Finance Committee adopt House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 214 Finance, Work Draft 34-GS2501/W, written by Walsh, dated May 2nd, 2026, as our working document.
Okay, and I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Also take a quick moment to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Allard and Representative Bynum. And with that, I'd like to ask my committee aide, Eric Gunderson, to the dais to explain the changes in version W. I'd also note that Legislative Finance Division is present in the room and online to assist with any technical questions. Mr. Gunderson, could you please put yourself on record? When you're ready, begin.
For the record, Eric Gunderson, staff to Representative Schrage in the House Finance Committee. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Schrage, Josephson Foster, and members of the House Finance Committee. Through the chair, before I begin, I'll go through the various reports provided to committee members. Report A provides a summary of the changes made in the committee substitute. Later on, this will be the primary document I use to run through the changes. Report B, labeled Project Compared by Agency House Structure, I think is one of the more helpful documents to help understand the changes in the committee substitute. It includes all the projects and changes made between this and the Senate version. Report C, Agency Summary House Structure, shows the statewide totals between the governor's version, the Senate version, and this committee substitute for agency totals, excluding supplemental and contingency items. Report D, statewide totals house structure, shows the fund source totals in the committee substitute. And finally, report E, project detail by agency house structure, shows all projects and changes between the three various versions of the capital budget. And that's all of the projects. Moving on to what is in the committee substitute. At a high level, the committee substitute brings the total amount of the capital budget to $347.2 million in unrestricted general funds, also known as UGF. $86.87 million in designated general funds, also known as DGF. $237.8 million in other funds, and $1.81 billion in federal receipts. If the contingent waterfall language, which I'll go over later, goes into effect, an additional roughly $26 million in UGF will be added, bringing the total to $373.1 million UGF. I'll now move on to the report letter A. For this handout, you'll see four columns. The first shows the project title. The second, labeled HCS 1 Edition, includes the amounts added in this CS. The third, labeled total, includes the total amount towards the project, including those with previous funding in the Senate version of the budget. And then the fourth column, note, shows a note, if there is one, that's associated. So moving on to the deferred maintenance projects, each one of these buckets is ordered by page number for those if you want to follow along in the bill. First up, there's an allocation to Mount Edgecombe High School for student housing upgrades. This is found on page 3. It is $5.2 million in designated general funds. This is from the Alaska Capital Income Fund. We also have another allocation to Mount Edgecombe High School to replace academic building envelopes for $5.1 million DGF. There's $48.4 million UGF for school major maintenance. This funds project 16 to 33. This is on pages 5 and 6. One note is that project 28 is partially funded at $6 million. We did talk with the department and found out that this project was originally slated to be on the new school construction list. This $6 million allows them to move forward with planning and initial phases, while also allowing the capital budget to move on and fund a number of other school major maintenance projects. Under new school construction, there is $6 million for the Deering K-12 school. This is on page 6. This builds on the funding for Stebbins K-12 that was added in the Senate. Next up, there's the UAF Campus Transit Fleet Maintenance Facility on page 24. This is $6.8 million total. $1.38 million of that is university receipts, and the rest is $5.44 million in federal receipts. There's an additional $15.3 million in UGF for university deferred maintenance on page 25. This funds the top 18 projects spread out between the UAA, UAF, and UAS campus on their deferred maintenance ranking list. We'll now move on to the AK LNG project workforce development projects. The first up is the Alaska Teamster Employee Service Trust Construction Driver and CDL Training Center. This is on page 3. The CS adds $2.2 million in aid receipts, bringing the total to $5.2 million. For the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center, there's an additional $2 million also in those other funds, aid receipts. Under AVTEC, Equipment Modernization and Facilities Upgrades, on page 8, there's an additional $2.32 million in other funds, which is the aid receipts. Moving on to the UA welding and non-destructive testing renovation, this can be found on page 24. There's $3 million in designated general funds. This fund source is the Capstone Avionics Revolving Loan Funds. This goes back to a revolving loan fund that was repealed in July of 2020. Ledge Finance has assured us that these funds are available for appropriation, and they're essentially kind of a zombie fund. These dollars are there and available for use, but don't have a statutory purpose. Next up, there's the UAA Industrial Cutting Systems and Electrical Distribution Upgrades on page 24. This is $260,000 from that same DGF fund source. I'll now move on to the other projects section. First up, there's the Renewable Energy Fund. This can be found on page 2. This is also known as REF. There's an additional $9.3 million in UGF added. This would bring the total funding to $14.6 million and fund the top 9 projects on the round 18 REF list. There's an additional $2 million for Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, bringing the total to $6 million. there is 217.5 thousand in those Capstone Avionics DGF fund source for the Alaska Library Network SLED and resources for literacy and online learning programs. There is also $450,000 in UGF for the Alaska Municipal League federal infrastructure implementation. This program, AML, helps local communities and tribes in grant writing to capture federal dollars and is an ongoing program. On page three, for the Alaska Travel Industry Association, there's an additional $2 million, bringing that total to $6 million. There's also an appropriation to the USS Ted Stevens commissioning support for $100,000. This is DGF from that same Capstone fund. There is also $15 million in UGF for the Port of Alaska cargo terminal replacement. There's associated waterfall language later on, which I'll go over. For the Fairbanks North Star Borough, there is $500,000 for the Arctic Winter Games planning and support. This is not the amount that the organization originally asked for. They had asked for $1.75 million. But we did reach out to them and work with them and found a number that fits within the budget and that allows them to get their feet off the ground and begin with the first year of planning. This builds on the $300,000 they've already raised, or roughly $300,000, which they'll receive in phases. But this allows them to do what they need to do for the first year and hopefully secure future funding in next legislatures. This is $400,000 UGF and $100,000 from the Capstone Avionics Fund. On page eight, there's the Emergency Medical Services Match Code Blue program. Next up, I'll go to the contingent waterfall section. The following appropriations that I'll go over are contingent on the 2027 fiscal year-to-date average price of Alaska North Slope crude oil being equal to or greater than $80 a barrel at the end of the fiscal year. If that happens, these projects will then go into effect and be appropriated. First up, there's an additional $10 million for the Don Young Port of Alaska terminal replacement. There's an additional $10.65 million for school major maintenance. This would bring the this would fund projects 34 through 38 on top of what was previously funded. There's $2 million for the UAS Sitka Campus Dock and Mariculture Training Facility, Phase 2. This was partially funded during last year's capital budget. There's $1.25 million for the UA Leaders Archive. Similarly, this was partially funded last year. There was quite a bit of federal and program receipts associated with it at that time. There is $2.05 million for court security projects. I should have mentioned these start on page 34 and go through page 35. I'll now move on to some of the miscellaneous items. The first one is the receipt authority for allocation for federal receipt authority for allocations to the West Usitna and Cascade Point projects have been removed. The West Usitna project, the receipt authority was $95 million and Cascade Point was a little over $39 million. Next up, the governor introduced two supplemental capital amendments. Both have been incorporated into this committee substitute. The first on page 30 is the election security grant under the Help America Vote Act. This is a little over $1 million for federal receipts and is typically an annual appropriation we receive from the federal government. under the Department of Family and Community Services, the amendment would reappropriate leftover funds from the Palmer Veterans and Pioneers Home to Pioneer Home system-wide deferred maintenance. I'll note this reappropriation was originally included in the Senate version of the capital budget going towards the Stebbins K through 12. This replaces that reappropriation, backfills that with UGF, and then the funds from that reappropriation then go towards the deferred maintenance for the Pioneer Homes. There's also intent language on the Office of the Governor reappropriations, requesting annual reports to the Finance Committee co-chairs and Legislative Finance. This can be found on page 44. And I believe last up, there's a return to a single fiscal year for the NPRA impact grants. This was a Ledge Finance recommendation and can be found on pages 38 and 39. And with that, that concludes my overview of the committee substitute.
All right, questions from committee members. Representative Allard.
Thank you. Co-chair Shragi, it looks like on page 24 of the HCS, lines 21 and 22, West Sestina Access Road. If you want to explain why you have, chosen to take that out of the capital budget.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Allard. I think the response would be multi-part. Part of it is that if you look at the STIP for this year, there is a great deal more federal authorization than there are federal funds available to be distributed. And there is some concern from members that I've spoken to that having such a large project with so much federal receipt authority when there's limited dollars will divert funds from other projects towards this one. And so this is partially an attempt to right-size the STIP. Additionally, through the public comment process that we've had here in this committee, there's been a lot of discussion and scrutiny of this project, and we want to give this project an opportunity for further scrutiny. And the best way to make that happen is by removing it from the STIP at this time.
I disagree, but thank you for your explanation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Allard. Additional questions or discussion from committee members? Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. To the chair, the specific item that we were just discussing with the excess money being removed from the budget, that was, correct me if I'm wrong, that was originally part of the governor's request. That was not an add in the Senate. Is that accurate?
And just to be clear, Representative Bynum, you're talking about the West Sioux?
Yes.
Yes, that's part of the technically it was not part of the original budget because it came through as part of the amendment package.
Right.
But, yes, it was a request from the administration as part of their STIP amendment process.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So do we have any additional information from Department of Transportation on any cascading effect that might have and or what kind of delays, if any, that it might – cause the project? Because I know that these things usually are, you know, long, they're in the STIP. It's a long focused or long planned project. And I'm just wondering if we have any idea if there's any negative impacts of the overall project by it being removed from this year's budget.
Thank you for the question, Representative Bynum. I would note, my recollection is that during the budget process, we did receive some correspondence from the Department of Transportation responding to some of our questions on this project during the committee process. Additionally, I'd note that I myself received a letter from the commissioner articulating some concern with the timeline. But again, that was personal communication with him, and I don't have great details on that. Yeah. Additional questions from committee members? All right. Well, with that, then, I will take a brief at ease. We'll be at ease at 1:52 p.m. We're at ease. All right, we're back on the record with Senate Bill 214 before us, the capital budget. We've got a motion to adopt the committee substitute, and I've objected for the purposes of discussion. Any additional questions or comments at this time, Representative Allard?
Yeah, thank you. I have real heartache with what is going on with the West Seuss, and I'm just trying to figure out how we can even consider adopting that with this. And so I don't know if this is the time to do it, but can we get DOT? They're on the line.
I don't believe DOT is online, but I can go ahead and check.
And I think Dom will be on the line.
I do not see them currently. What I will say, Representative Allard, is that this bill is before our committee. Today we're adopting the CS. We will continue to have possession of this bill for at least the next few days, and that'll provide opportunity for further discussion with DOT and any other stakeholders that members may want to consult with or that the committee may want to consult with. So I appreciate you expressing your concern, and I think we'll have an opportunity this week to follow up on those.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to be adopting something, and I think that it's fair to have that input from the Department of Transportation when we're adopting such an important document. Could we just give him a couple more minutes so that I could Dom could reference the letter that he sent to you, and we, as the rest of the committee, had seen, or some of us at least.
I absolutely appreciate that, Representative Allard. I think that there's certainly we want to make sure that members have an opportunity to ask questions and vet that information. We do also have many bills on the calendar for today, and I want to be efficient with our committee's time. What I'll say is we should take the opportunity to make sure that letter gets distributed to committee members and then allow for further discussion on that at a later time.
All right.
But thank you, Representative Allard. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. We have the CS in front of us, and there's many things I think that are important in this CS, things that I have talked about in this committee. When we talk about capital, there is deferred maintenance items that are listed here. There's funding that's much needed for school facilities. That's been an ongoing conversation that we've had. So there's many things that I think are good in here, not only from what was submitted from the governor, but what came from the Senate and then what was put in the House through this House CS. I do have some concern overall. I know that this isn't a big UGF, particularly a UGF item, but the West Asitna Access Project. I'd hope that although that is removed here and not included in the CS, I would hope that we would be able to continue to have a conversation about the importance of resource development and potential access for resource development in Alaska, and along with the construction of and development of roadways. So I'd hope that, Mr. Chairman, that we would have a commitment that we can at least continue to have that conversation. I know that we're not going to be able to change this today, but we will have an opportunity for amendments and further conversation. I would just hope that we'd have that commitment.
Absolutely, Representative Bynum. I fully expect this committee to have the normal process, including the establishment of an amendment deadline, which we'll touch on shortly, an amendment process where members will be able to offer changes to the capital budget and speak to those, have a discussion here at the committee before moving the bill along. So absolutely appreciate the desire to have that discussion and think that that is something we should absolutely do. You do have that commitment from me.
Thank you.
And Representative Tomaszewski, do I see you hoping to get in the queue? Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. I'm going to talk a little bit about that West Sioux also. It says you're removing the receipt authority for the allocations to West Asitna. Is that receipt authority going to another project, or what exactly is the plan for that receipt authority for that project? And do we lose that if we do not adopt, continue this on with the bill?
Thanks for the question, Representative Tomaszewski. In my conversations with Legislative Finance and the department, my understanding is that we do not have the ability to move federal authority around amongst STIP projects. What we do have the opportunity to do is to reduce or eliminate STIP funding, specifically the federal receipt authority. That does not reduce the total amount of federal receipts that are available out there, and it's my understanding that looking at the number of STIP projects that are included in the STIP, that there will be an opportunity to still receive that same level of funding. We're just eliminating receipt authority from one specific project. But because There is more receipt authority across all of those STIP projects than there are federal funds. This should not reduce the total amount of federal funds that the state would be receiving for STIP projects.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. And again, we'll have an opportunity to further scrutinize this over the next few days and have further discussion. Representative Allard?
Thank you, Co-Chair. So I'm going to bring it back up again because I really think it's important before we vote to adopt something that's going to completely probably be adopted, that's going to be stricken out. I really would appreciate it if you could pass out that letter prior to us adopting it.
Representative Allard, we have a very tight schedule today. I understand if you're not comfortable voting for the committee substitute today. I respect that and understand if you need to vote no. But for my purposes today, I'd like to move forward with this vote, and we'll have the opportunity over the next few days to make sure that we're all receiving the same information.
And just a quick follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up, Co-Chair. Representative Allard.
Yeah, this isn't for me. This is for the public, and I think that letter is very crucial that we discuss it beforehand. And I get we have a tight schedule, but I mean, honestly, you're the co-chair. We could be here after floor and come back, adjourn, and talk about it. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Allard. I appreciate it very much. Any further discussion from committee members? Representative Stapp?
Yeah, I think, Co-Chair Schrage, I'll do my talking here rather than at the objection time frame, I suppose. I obviously there's an old saying, if you got the votes, vote, and if you don't, talk. So I'm just going to say I hope the committee throughout this process will reconsider this decision, that we've talked a lot this session about our 9-to-1 federal match. This deletes a sizable chunk of that over and beyond what's necessary in the STIP. It's $94 million. And also, like, the West Sioux Access Project is one of the few things that we have in Alaska that is going toward positive steps for resource development. We're a resource development state. We should have policies, in my opinion, on the Finance Committee that are driven for the future development of resources to be able to unlock Alaska and give all Alaskans opportunity to be able to thrive through our collective resource ownership. So, I like the CS minus a couple of things, obviously, and we'll be maintaining my objection over the deletion of the West Sioux Access Road. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Thank you, Representative Stapp. I appreciate the comments. All right. I'm not seeing any additional discussion from committee members. So with that, I'm going to remove my objection. Is there further objection?
Checked.
All right, very good. With there being an objection maintained, I'd like to ask the clerk to call the roll, please.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Bynum.
No.
Representative Stapp.
No.
Representative Jimmy.
Pass.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Galvin.
Yes.
Representative Tomaszewski.
No.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Schrage.
Yes.
6 yay, 5 nay.
All right. On a vote of 6 yay, 5 nay, the committee substitute has been adopted for Senate Bill 214, version W. For this bill, I am setting an amendment deadline of Wednesday, May 6th at 4 p.m. An email will be sent to committee members and staff with details on the amendment drafting process. All right. With that, we're going to take a brief at ease while we transition the gavel. Thank you, everyone. We're at ease.
Easy.
Meet the match.
Look at my...
Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee back to order. The time is currently 2:06 p.m., and we do have four bills that we're going to attempt to address today, and those four bills are House Bill 261, the Education Funding Bill. We just wanted to bring this back for the committee when we left off last. There are some folks who had some questions, and so we want to just make sure that folks are able to ask their questions. After that, we have Senate Joint Resolution 29, that's Constitutional Amendment Educational Funding. We're going to be doing amendments on that, taking up amendments. And then after that, the third bill is Senate Bill 86. That's the Money Transmission and Virtual Currency Bill, taking up amendments on that. And then we'll be receiving a reintroduction of a bill we heard last year. That's House Bill 104. That's the Address Confidentiality Program. Couple of things. We do need to be back on the floor at about 3, so we have a hard stop at about 2:55. I don't foresee us being able to get to all of these bills by then, so there's the possibility that, depending on how long we go on the floor, we may come back later, recess out, and then come back later, but we'll see how long we go on the floor, and we'll let folks know. So with that, we'll jump right into House Bill 261, Education Funding. If we could have Representative Story come up, as well as her staff, Ms. Tammy Smith. And if you could put yourselves on the record. And I thought I had a list here of folks who had questions. I'm not seeing that, but we'll just we do have some folks who do have questions. So Representative Story, just to, again, kind of get us moving in the same direction here, real quick recap of the bill.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster and committee members, for hearing the bill again. My name is Representative Andy Story, representing District 3, Northern Mendenhall Valley, Haines, Skagway, Cluck 1, and Gustavus. Yes, the bill before you, House Bill 261, reforms our education funding process. It is an opportunity where we can put our state online with giving our districts their number, their student count number, on July 1st. As they go through the year, the community can budget it more with certainty. Municipalities can have their number in March and April based on a set student count that's been verified by deed during the October process. But most importantly, our teachers, we can give out their contracts to our teachers earlier in the year. And this is very important for keeping our teachers in the classroom. We know that our funding is based on our head count, our student count, and the amount of the BSA, based student allocation. So this does not fix everything, because we still always are wrestling with how much funding should we give to, what investment we should make to our public education system. But this is really transformative, I believe, in how we would be doing our taking a three-year average or the previous year, and starting July 1st with districts knowing their number for the year.
Great. Thank you very much. We've got a question, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So I'm looking at the fiscal note for the Public Education Fund, OMB component number 2804, and it has a total operating budget of $113,710,000. And I'm looking at another a duplicate of that fiscal note that was February the 21st. It's the same number. The new one that you have in this packet is from April 14th. There's a discrepancy on the amount. So it's a $34 million dollars more on the February 21st fiscal note, which is $147 million. I'm just curious as what changed in the, I think it's maybe an earlier version of the bill. And can you kind of explain where that $34 million went?
Representative Story.
Thank you for that question. We're looking for that note, but we do have deed online. The justification for the analysis is on the back of that, so we will try and find that. But deed is online, and they prepared all those fiscal notes for us.
Ms. Heather Heineken, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. This is Heather Heineken, the Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education. And I'm going to try and see if I can get the right versions of the fiscal notes that you're referring to. So the first fiscal note is, I apologize, could you repeat which fiscal notes you're referring to? Because let me start with, through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. There has been some language changes in the bill. Originally, the alternative programs language was put in, and then it was removed, and then it was put back in. So that's one change. And then also, because of the complexities in this bill, the department had to clarify language, and we did have to rerun some fiscal notes. So I just want to make sure I'm looking at the right versions before I try and answer your question specifically. But that is the overview of the most of the changes.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Director Heineken. I appreciate that. So the earlier version fiscal note dated February the 21st is control code OUDCW, and that is a $147 million fiscal note. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wanted to compare that with the same fiscal note, just it's a different date, and that's the one you ran through, and that one is control code SEYBM. And so that one has $113 million fiscal note. And I just want to know how did we lose the $34 million approximately from one to the next?
And if I could, Representative Story, just would like to make a comment.
Thank you for that. And through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski. We had a version when we first started this where we were doing an averaging, a three-year average of our intensive student count. And we removed that in the most recent version and are not taking a three-year averaging of the intensive student count. We are just taking either the previous year, the current year, or truing it up in February. So we had four options originally, and then we decided to take out the three-year averaging for the intensive student count because we realized the previous year would be the best thing to do because we had those intensive student counts for that previous year. They were just in the district, and it was a lot of money to do like a three-year averaging, and that had to be that was some concern about possibly doing double on times 13 intensive child.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you. And so if I could hear from Director Heineken, if she can kind of go over that also, because that seems, I guess I'm curious, was the special needs count really a $34 million note on that, Director Heineken?
Ms. Heineken.
Thank you, Heather Heineken, for the record, through the chair, to Representative Tomaszewski. Yes, between those two versions, that is the main factor, is the special education intensive count. One intensive count is, and these are approximates, I don't have the figure in front of me, but it's about $83,000 per change in one intensive count. So it's a pretty significant difference when we start looking at those as an average as opposed to actuals.
Follow up. So that's 83,000 per student change.
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, yes. For an intensive student, that is about the cost per ADM.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Do we have further questions? Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Story. Appreciate this bill. I appreciate what we're trying to do with it. I know we do have an amendment deadline on the bill. I mean, overall, I think the general concept is something I can get behind. The current construction of the bill I have some issues with the optional features of the bill. So if it was purely a three-year average and then there was a true-up for extraordinary circumstances, I'd be more inclined to be side-by-side with you on the bill, even if there was a immediate fiscal note, which we know that over time would alleviate or go away. So I look forward to the amendment process and look forward to talking with you as well a little bit further. I just wanted to let you know that I do appreciate this effort. And in general, I do support generalized concept, but just not in its current form. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And with that, just a reminder that the amendment deadline is today at 5 p.m. And then my hope is to maybe address those amendments tomorrow So with that, I think we're going to take a very quick brief at ease here. We do have next up Senate Joint Resolution 29, the Constitutional Amendment to Educational Funding. We do have amendments for that, and I think we may be waiting for the bill sponsor. So we'll take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:18 p.m. And we have Senate Joint Resolution 29 before us. And if we could have Mr. Tim Grusendorf come up, Senator Hoffman's staff. And if you could just put yourself on the record and give us a brief recap of the bill, and then we're going to jump into amendments. I think we've got three amendments. So, Mr. Grusendorf.
Good morning, Mr. Co-chair, or good afternoon, Mr. Co-chair, co-chairs, and House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Tim Grusendorf, staff to Senator Hoffman and the Senate Finance Committee. In front of you again today is SJR 29, which proposes to create a dedicated fund in the Constitution for the purposes of education and put that before the voters in the fall.
Great. Thank you very much. So with that, members should have the amendment packet before them. And Representative Hannon, would you like to offer your first amendment?
I move Amendment 1.
Okay, an object for purposes of discussion. Representative Hannon.
I have a brief at ease.
Sure, brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:21 p.m. And let's see, I objected to amendment number 1 for purposes of discussion. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Amendment 1 addresses what I heard in our discussion as two concerns about SJR 29. The first was we had a lot of discussion around the way May and regarding the creation of the fund. And there were worries that voters might think they're approving and mandating that we create this fund, but no guarantee that the legislature would subsequently go and create the fund. So this amendment puts that to rest by instead mirroring language that we find already in the Constitution in Article 9, Section 17 of the Constitution that creates the Budget Reserve Fund. So the amendment deletes the words, the legislature may create an education fund, and replaces it with, there is established a separate fund in the state treasury, the Public Education Fund. And I think, you know, concerns of does the public believe and is it mandated? Well, this would make it clear that that's what this amendment if it were before the voters does. The second concern was to make crystal clear that the fund to be established is for public education only. So the amendment drums this home by inserting the word public before education fund in several places where the current version it's absent. It does appear in some places already in the version. This makes it consistent throughout SJR 29. Every time the education fund is referenced, it would then read public education fund. That's what the amendment one does.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any questions of the committee? Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'm kind of mixed on this amendment. I know that there was some discussion about whether or not the legislature may or may not have the authority to create the fund. This amendment is stating that if the constitutional amendment was passed, that there shall be a fund established for public education. My thought on this is that I wouldn't want to give up the legislative authority to be able to create the fund. I don't particularly have a problem with the May language. I actually prefer it. I do believe that there was some discussion about defining it as a public education fund. I think that that is something that we should do. But overall, I don't know that I'm fully behind the idea of it saying that we shall establish a fund for this purpose. I still think that we should have the latitude to be able to create the fund. So I support the underlying bill. I'm not sure that I support this amendment for that reason.
Okay. Further discussion, Representative Galvin?
Yeah, I have a question for the maker of the amendment or perhaps for Ledge Legal. If it says the legislature, there is established, does that mean that there has to be funds in it, or can it be a fund sitting there waiting for funds in it?
Ms. Marie Marks, could you put yourself on the record?
Yeah. Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, I'm calling from my Ring app, not on speakerphone, so hopefully you can hear me a little bit better this time. And the question was whether the legislature had to put money in the fund if it is established in the Constitution. And the answer would be no, there's no requirement in SJR 29 to fund the public education fund at a specific level. That would be a policy call to be left to the legislature to decide how much to appropriate or how much land to transfer into the fund.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Shoggy.
Yeah, thank you. Just to Mr. Grissendorf, have the Senate co-chairs had an opportunity to look at the amendments today? And do you have a position that you can relay on this amendment?
Mr. Grissendorf.
To the chair, Representative Shoggy. I don't believe the Senate has an opinion on this piece of it. For the intent at the end, if this amendment was not adopted, I would have put on the record that the intent was that the legislature can establish, revoke and reenact the fund or bring it back, but by law. But I wasn't going to, but this eliminates the need for that because it just says that it will be enacted, so you don't have to worry about enact or reenact or anything like that to be on the record.
Further discussion, Representative Sapp.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. I'm not entirely sure adding the words public is actually necessary given the other constitutional provision that already says that we're not allowed to kind of spend state funds on education. So there's a mandate for education in the state constitution. I don't necessarily have a problem with the amendment from the maker to define that. I just don't think it's necessarily necessary because you already have the constitutional provision.
Further discussion? Seeing none, I am – oh, Representative Tom Chester.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. The chair, I'd like Ms. Marks, if she can comment on that by inserting the word public, does that remove any kids off of the ability, out of the ability to actually take part in this public education fund? Is it a, is it discriminatory against any particular group of kids that it would actually bar from using this public education fund?
Ms. Marks?
Yeah, again, for the record, Marie Marks with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, that brings up a really good point about how a court interprets terms and phrases in the Alaska Constitution. And when the court was interpreting the meaning of a term in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, in the case of Sickle v. Cooper, the court said, we will interpret an amendment, and that was similarly done through an amendment process by the people. We will consider the section's plain language, its purposes, its legislative history, and contemporary evidence about voters' understanding of the constitutional amendment, meaning the statement in support and the statement in opposition. So therefore, it's very important and what the legislative record shows of the meaning. And so I guess what I would recommend is that the committee make it very clear on the meeting what they mean by public education. As we discussed before, there's no definition in the Constitution, in state statutes or Black Law Dictionary, which is often looked at by the court in interpreting it. It is true that Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution refers to public education, but the University of Alaska section in Article 7, Section 2 does not. There's a difference between, I think, public education, which is a very, very broad term, and a narrower term of public schools. And so under, I think, the plain meaning of the term, if the court just turned to the plain meaning and didn't look at the pro and con statements and the legislative record that you established here through the process, I think it could be very broad, and it would likely include all public education programs, such as public correspondence programs, public correspondence schools, public charter schools, state boarding school, and so forth.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, wrap up, Representative Hannon.
I don't think I need any wrap up, but I would urge your support. And I just think making it clear that if this goes before the voters, that they're voting to establish a fund. It does not fund the fund, but it establishes it. And I think I really support having that clarity before the voters so they understand at the outset that there's a binary decision. The decision to fund it is a secondary one that will be made by legislatures if this were put in place.
Okay, thank you. Did I? No, okay. I'm going to remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Hearing none, amendment number one has been adopted. That takes us to amendment number two, Representative Galvin.
I move amendment two.
I'll object for purposes of discussion, Representative Galvin.
Okay, so this amendment does two things to this bill. After speaking with the sponsor staff, I felt that this might be helpful. The amendment puts the proceeds of a state tax or license dedicated to and deposited into the education fund for K-12 students. And then I think it's important, since that's our duty in the Constitution, that we make that clear. And then secondly, the amendment specifically focuses on providing funds for the instruction in the classroom. Funds cannot be used for major maintenance or deferred maintenance. We have a process for that currently in the state. This is crucial, as allowing for major maintenance and capital improvement funds would take over most of the fund if it's not clear here. And I think that in that case, there wouldn't be funds left over for the teachers and rising costs of operating a classroom. And again, we have the burger program and lots of ways that we're determining how to handle major maintenance. So that's what this amendment does.
Okay, discussion. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I guess this might be a question for legal, and it's something I probably should have asked under the previous amendment. The way that the original SJR was written is that it allowed the legislature to create a law establishing this fund. And within that law, it allowed the legislature to tailor specifically components of the law. Amendment 1 basically had changed that, and it said that there shall be a fund established. Does this still allow the legislature once to create or define in law the elements of that fund and how it would function, or did the Amendment 1 take away the ability of the legislature to do that?
Ms. Marks?
Yeah. Marie Marks, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair, Representative Bynum. The legislature could establish parameters for the Constitutional Education Fund subject to existing provisions of the Constitution. So it could fund it in using different structures, financial structures, maybe an endowment, it appropriates revenue every year into it and spends the full amount of the revenue, but it still would be subject to the current provisions of the Constitution regarding a majority vote to appropriate funds out of it and other, you know, other provisions of the Constitution.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you. And for the record, if you noticed on the last amendment, I did not object to vote no on that. I can live with the fact that we would agree that it would be an established fund. But with that being said, as I would still like to see some legislative authority over the fund. I understand that from our discussions prior that having elements or language in the Constitution to allow dedicated funding sources or revenue sources to the fund is something that is absolutely necessary. It's not something that we can do through law and then make sure that it would stay in. So as far as the language goes here in Amendment Number 2, I don't have any issues with items that are in lines 1 through 8. The items in lines 9 through 12 I do have an issue with. I think that is something that can be established through the legislature when we go to create the fund. I would hate to block us in with being able to say that we wouldn't be able to dedicate tax revenues or fees into this fund or another fund for the purposes of these other items. So with that, I would like to make a conceptual amendment 1 to amendment 2 that would delete or remove lines 9 through 12.
Okay, we have an objection, and let's go to Mr. Grusendorf and then Representative Stapp. Mr. Grusendorf.
To the chair, Representative Bynum, if you would look at the line 10 of the amendment, this is something that wasn't mentioned. It says, and then you go to the bill on line 13, after education as defined by law. So that is giving the legislature to be able to define public education. So you can't, that's where you get the parameters. So if you take that piece out, you will not be able to set the parameters because that is as defined by law after public education, that is what's letting the legislature define what public education means to them.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, if you need to talk, I'll defer. Okay, or I'll go.
Representative Biden.
Defer.
Yeah, I withdraw that amendment. And I see as defined by law, I would want to have a full stop there and remove the section, everything after that, which would then let us define it. So, but I don't know. I don't want to mess up the process here. So I can just remove my amendment and make another amendment if that's appropriate. Okay.
So amendments number 1 to amendment number 2 will be withdrawn by Representative Bynum. And Representative Bynum, would you like to restate an amendment?
Correct. Thank you. I'd like to make conceptual amendment 2 to amendment 2, which would remove after the words defined by law, the language from lines 10 through 12.
Okay, Representative Stapp. We have an objection. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, okay, so I am going to support the conceptual amendment 2 to amendment 2. Reason being is I think that you want to be as least prescriptive in term in putting things in the Constitution. It says for students in kindergarten through 12, money in the education fund may not be appropriated for capital project, capital improvement, or major maintenance. I think that, though there probably isn't an issue with saying things like kindergarten through grade 12 in the Constitution, there might be a future date in which we don't have those things, or we'd call them something different, right? So, and I think if you look at the framers of the Constitution, not only they were against any type of dedicated funds, they also wanted us to be as flexible and as least prescriptive as possible. And I feel like getting rid of that language, though we may not want that, if you prescribe that in statute in a future legislature, has a bill to prescribe that in statute, it would take a future legislature to again change that purpose in law. And I think that would preserve flexibility in budgeting through the chair. Thanks.
And Representative Bynum, just so we have clarity in terms of the difference between Amendment Conceptual 1 and Conceptual 2, can you restate Conceptual 2?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Yes, what Conceptual Amendment 2 of 2 would do is after the words, as defined by law, there would be a period there, and it would remove the remainder of that sentence and the next sentence.
Great, perfect. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Grusendorf, any comments?
Through the chair, there, and when talking with the senators on the other body, they did not intend this to go for construction or major maintenance. Was their original thought? Because there's already a process established for that, and they did realize that. The big cry out for education right now, although we do have maintenance and major maintenance and construction concerns, we are very concerned about the instruction in the classroom and the BSA. We've been having these battles, so they thought that this would eat away too much when we need to get more money towards the classroom and K through 12. They thought it should be limited to that, not pre-K and not college and the university afterwards, which we thought the Constitution, when they put what they put in there for that, the legislature and that state was, it was there, they should follow, and they need to fund public education in the Constitution. I don't think they were talking about anything below kindergarten or anything above, you know, 12, K through 12. So this seems to fit with that intent.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? Representative Hannon?
I'm going to support Conceptual Amendment 2 to Amendment 2 because we're drafting constitutional language. And although I agree with the perception from the Senate that I believe our intent is to look at operational costs, I don't think getting that specific in the Constitution puts us in a good stead. Now, if this passes by the voters and is a constitutional amendment, we as a legislature would be called back to define by law what we mean by this fund, and speaking to its intent or purpose primarily be operational costs. But again, you know, in the last 20 years, we've learned a lot about preschool and early education being critical. And so one of the things, for instance, in law, we don't mandate kindergarten in Alaska. We're one of the few states, but to put it in our Constitution seems overly prescriptive, but not reflecting the norm. And I could foresee, let's just say someday this is a multi-billion-dollar fund, and we have numbers of schools that have burned down, been destroyed, flooded out. And for that year, we need to make some intense capital investment and turn to that fund. Although that's not what I'm envisioning. I don't want the Constitution to prohibit us from doing that in a time and place that we were. So I'm going to support Amendment 2 to Amendment 2.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. In hearing the discussion, I have to also concur with this amendment to the amendment. It's a friendly amendment to me. And the reason is the conversation around the Constitution and how important it is to leave some of the terminology very broad, but yet still give the control to the legislature to define at some point. And so for that reason, I will be supporting Amendment 2 to Amendment 2.
Is the objection maintained, Representative Moore?
I'll withdraw my objection.
Okay, the objection has been withdrawn. And I don't see any further objections. So Amendment number 2 to Amendment number 2 has been adopted. That takes us back to the main amendment. Representative Josephson.
Question for Ms. Marks on Amendment 2 as amended by Amendment Conceptual Amendment 2. Through the chair, Ms. Marks, when we say, I apologize and I will make it right with the committee. when we say the proceeds of a state tax or license, in your testimony, Ms. Marks, from last week, I guess it must have been, I think you said that there was that a, for example, a $50 head tax could not be put in the fund, but a special appropriation could. Did you say something like that?
Ms. Marks?
Marie Marks, Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, correct. SJR 9, as currently written at that time, would not legally allow the dedication of money directly into the fund.
All right. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
It's pretty obviously that under Amendment 2 as amended, it could do that. And my question is, it says the proceeds of a state tax or a license, would it have to be all of a state tax? So if we raised, I don't know, let's say our motor fuel tax wasn't the lowest in the country, but it was 25th in the country. Could we spend 80% of that increase on this item, or would we have to spend 100%?
Remarks, Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, again, would reiterate that the legislature should put its intent, what it intends, on the record, so it's very clear. I think the common understanding, just by the plain language, is by law means the legislature could, by a bill, establish a percentage of the proceeds. If it does not, by law, would not have to be the full proceeds. I think that's the common understanding. If the legislature would like a different understanding, I think it's really important to put that on the record.
All right. And I don't want a different understanding than that, so I'm going to leave that language right there on the record. And then lastly, a follow-up, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
The use of the word license, tell us what you think that means to you, Ms. Marks.
Yeah, remarks, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair. Representative Josephson, that is the phrase that's used in Article 9, Section 7 that has been interpreted to mean the source of any public revenue. So that phrase, proceeds of any tax or license, is used here because that is the exact phrase used in the dedicated funds clause. But in State v. Alex, the court said that if any public revenue, tax, license, rental, sale, royalty, whatever, is included in that phrase. Again, I think that it would be important for the legislator to put on the record that it means, you know, any source of public revenue, if that's the intent.
Follow. So in State v. Alice, the Supreme Court said it's any source of revenue that has been taxed. Is that? Can you repeat what you said?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it was interpreting the phrase, what does any tax or license mean? And in the Alex case, it involved assessments, and the question is whether these assessments were a tax or license. And so the court said, in the anti-dedication clause in the Alaska Constitution, with the use of the word state tax, tax or license, it means any revenue that is any public revenue is subject to the anti-dedication clause. So here, the amendment provides an exception to the anti-dedication clause, meaning it allows the legislature to dedicate and deposit directly into the education fund a source of revenue as set out by law, by the legislature in a bill.
All right, that's sufficient. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hannon?
My question was the same as Representative Josephson's.
Okay. Any further discussion on Amendment number 2 as amended? Representative Galvin?
Thank you. I just wanted to urge support for this
amendment. I do appreciate the Senate's intent originally in trying to make sure that the public understands that they see the people in education, the teachers, the educators who are part of it, get the support that's needed. I think that clearly we are experiencing a time unlike any others with regard to our out-migration of educators. So I do appreciate the intent of trying to carve that out if possible. And yet, after becoming aware of so many emergencies that do happen and also how important it is to keep flexibility in and general language in anything that would touch the Constitution, I really do appreciate this amended amendment, and I hope that you'll support it. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection. Any further objections? Seeing none, amendment number 2 as amended has been adopted. And so that takes us to amendment number 3, and I assume you're going to – I'm just debating whether or not I want to recess.
I'm going to offer this amendment 3 if you'll allow me, or we can wait. It's up to you.
I'm thinking we're supposed to be going to the floor here. I'm seeing some folks who would like to maybe have a little time to take care of some things before we go to the floor. So what we're going to do is we'll come back to amendment number 3 hopefully a little later. And we'll figure it out depending on how long the floor session goes. So what I'd like to do for now is go ahead and recess House Finance at 2:48 p.m., and we'll announce later when we're coming back. So with that, we're at recess. Okay, House Finance back on record at 4:01 p.m. And just giving a heads up to the public that may be watching that we are, once we get our full cadre of finance members, we will be going back to our amendment process, which is we're on amendment number 3. We'll be taking that up. They'll be moving that. And we are on Senate Joint Resolution 29, which is proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to a public education fund. And we just have a few more people that will be coming in here. And once we have the last amendments, this is the third amendment of 3, I will entertain whether or not the committee is interested in moving the bill. And then after that, we do have two more bills. We'll be doing 5 amendments for Senate Bill 86, and that is the Money Transmission and Virtual Currency Bill. And then at the end, we will be doing, we'll be walking through House Bill 104, that is the Address Confidentiality Program Bill. It is very possible that we may be adjourning at 5 o'clock also, so we may not get through all of that. But as the time draws near, we'll get a sense of how things are looking. So I'm going to take it at ease and just wait for the rest of our members to come in. I think we just have 2 more. And just want to let the public know that we're still on Senate Joint Resolution 29, which is a constitutional amendment for educational funding. And so we'll come back to Eddie's. Okay, House Finance back on record at 4:04 p.m. And just a moment ago, I kind of announced the remainder of the day. I think the big issue there is we have a number of folks who may not be able to stay through the evening, so we might shoot to try to get out by 5. So that gives us about an hour. We do have Senate Joint Resolution 29, Constitutional Amendment, Educational Funding. We've got 1 amendment left, and we got 5 amendments for the next bill, which is SB 86, the virtual currency, and then an introduction to 104, HB 104, and that is the confidentiality program. So we're going to jump right into it. Representative Bynum, would you like to make a motion to introduce amendment number 3?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move amendment number 3.
Okay, and we have an objection. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Amendment number 3 does something very specific. What it does is it basically mimics what we did in the Constitution for our natural resources revenues, specifically that there's a 25% requirement to be deposited into the permanent fund. But what this does is it does something beyond that in the sense that it – still takes all of those revenues that are supposed to go to the permanent fund, and it doesn't disrupt that. It just says that any additional funds that are left over after we do that, that we take and dedicate those funds to this education fund. Education, as we know, is constitutionally required. It's a constitutional requirement. It is one of the largest expenditures that we have in the state outside of health and welfare. And what I wanted to make sure that we did is that we we do a couple things here. We know that when we invest money directly from revenues into the permanent fund through our constitutional requirement, that that creates a public pressure to want us to have development of our resources. And I think that's valuable. What this amendment is doing is it's saying that from a new resource that we develop, specifically a major gas line project, that instead of taking these additional revenues that are flowing to the general fund, that we take and we direct them directly to this education fund, or at least 75% of them. Right now, I saw that the projections on the gas line is somewhere in the realm of $700 million of revenue that would be forecasted for the line on a year after basis. At least that's the most that I've seen that projection will show. In the future, we don't know what other kind of additional revenues we could get from a gas line, but I would encourage or hope that we could expand that in a significant way. So, one moment here. Basically, what this amendment would do is that it would dedicate hundreds of millions of dollars, or over $400 million, if those gains are truly realized. Now, the question is why put it into the Constitution? And I'm putting this into the Constitution because year after year we talk about wanting to have a dedicated streaming source of revenue into the education, and this will do that. What we do right now is we appropriate money. We appropriate money by a statutory formula. This doesn't take away from that, but it does direct a specific amount of money, and it does create a desire to see that development of gas in Alaska for the benefit of Alaska, but also for the benefit of our schools. That's what this amendment does.
Okay, thank you very much. Also, if I could have Mr. Grusendorf come back up just in case we've got questions, Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So reluctantly, I'm not going to be in support of the amendment. A couple of reasons. Number one, as I kind of mentioned earlier in the committee, it is much more efficient just to deposit the earnings of your gas royalty or production tax or whatever type of revenue sources that you have into the permanent fund, and then appropriate the money out of the permanent fund as we do currently, rather than direct a dedicated earmark in the Constitution. It's, to me, the argument's actually not dissimilar to not wanting to be super prescriptive. Also, in the language of the amendment, it says a substantial adjacent infrastructure. I don't know what that means. It has a gas pipeline and substantial adjacent infrastructure. And my fear would be if you put substantial adjacent infrastructure into the Constitution, that might be a lot of things that we haven't thought about yet. So I'm going to be a no, but appreciate the maker of the amendment for looking at a stable and reliable funding source for education.
Further discussion? Okay. Mr. Grusendorf, thoughts?
No, through the chair, no. I'll let the committee decide what they want to do.
Okay. Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I do appreciate the members' efforts to make sure if we're establishing a fund that there is a substantive amount of money going to it, but I am going to oppose the amendment. And primarily because I think it's too specific to add into the Constitution how it's funded. I think first we need the authority from the voters to fund it. Secondly, I think it might imply that there is to voters that it's somehow tied to support of a gas line being created, and that if we don't create that as a revenue source, that we can't add other revenues. And I don't want that to be perceived. Now, I think if the gas line that we're talking about comes online and has a generous amount of extra revenue to the state, and a future legislature decides to either amend and specify it or just on a periodic basis take that revenue and put it into endow a fund, I think those are separate decisions. But I want to make sure that when voters are talking and thinking about voting on a constitutional amendment, that it's not tied to another thing being the critical feature. They only support it if it's gas line revenue. They only support it if the revenue comes from a set location. So I'm not opposed to revenue from the gas line going to an education endowment, but I am not going to support the amendment at this point to amend the Constitution that we're – constitutional amendment we're being proposed to put before the voters to tie those two together.
Okay. Further discussion? Wrap up, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And again, I'll just clarify that right now we spend $1.5 billion on education or in the request that I hear coming from the legislature, from teachers and parents, is that we spend even more than that. Projected revenue from the current gas line that we are having a big debate about and a desire to see in Alaska right now has a projected revenue of about $700 million and potentially could be more, especially if we see additional development, which is what I'd like to see us encourage us to do. This doesn't take away from Amendment 2 that was passed. Amendment 2 allows us to take taxes and fees and direct those into an education fund, and it doesn't persuade us from – or it prevents us from when we dedicate them for that purpose that the legislature can't then take and remove those funds. So I brought this forward to make sure that we have a sizable, substantial, continuous – revenue source for education that doesn't just fully depend upon what's coming from the earnings of oil or from the earnings of our permanent fund. Appreciate your support on Amendment 3.
Okay, Representative Stepp, do you maintain your objection?
I maintain my objection.
Okay, the objection is maintained. Madam Clerk, if you could call the roll on Amendment number 3.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Hannon.
No.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Galvin.
No.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Jimmy.
No.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
No.
Representative Shragi.
No.
Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
2 yea, 9 nay.
On a vote of 2 yea and 9 nay, Amendment number 3 has not been adopted. So that is the completion of our amendment process. And if it is the will of the committee, I would ask if there is a motion to move the resolution from committee.
Co-Chair Foster, I move Senate Joint Resolution 29, Work Order 34-LS1570/A out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Object.
We have an objection, Representative Stepp. Would you like to speak to your objection?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Co-Chair Foster. Geez, it's been a long day, right? I'm going to lift my objection after a talk, but I mean, just on a structural level, I talked earlier in the hearings about how I went out and I read the minutes from the Constitutional Convention, and I can tell you that it is incredibly clear that the fathers of Alaska's Constitution repeatedly rejected constitutional earmarks. Education was treated as a constitutional duty and intentionally not a fiscal formula with a dedicated fund. Our framers wanted a short and flexible constitution. And perhaps the most telling thing about the Alaska's Constitutional Convention is no delegate proposed a dedicated fund for education at the time that the state wrote its constitution. And I understand that, you know, things change over time, but I just say I'm going to err on the side of the folks who kind of started this process of our 49th state, had a very good understanding of this issue, and they rejected constitutional dedicated funds for a reason. Thanks. And with that, I remove my objection.
Okay, your objection is removed. Representative Bynum, would you like to object? Okay, Representative Bynum. Yes.
Thank you. Objecting for the purpose of the discussion here. Could have had my friend from Fairbanks to hold on to that for a minute, and I could have gave my comment. But, I think the concept behind SJR 29 is not a bad concept. I think it just codifies with the vote of the people something into the Constitution that we're already doing and required. I would have some concerns. I've listed some of the concerns that I've had with what it may or may not do and what the legislature could or couldn't do. But ultimately, they can do those things pretty much right now anyway. The expense and cost of what we have for our current education system and future education system is, it's a big lift for the state. And I can't foresee anything that we're going to be able to do to create an endowment, at least at this point. When we take this up and we put it to the voters, that we would have an endowment big enough to support education. But maybe in 50 or 60 years, there'll be additional resources that have been brought online or growth in our economy that would allow us to do that. And so I think it's not a bad idea to potentially have that available. And ultimately, this has given the voters a choice. So I'm not going to oppose it. I actually, you know, the more I think about it, the more I actually like the idea of giving us that opportunity to have it available. I don't know if legal is still on the phone, but I did have one more quick question before we have this going, if that's okay.
Representative Bynum, Marie Marks is on the line.
Thank you, Ms. Marks. Amendment number 2 talked about allowing dedicated revenue sources for taxes and fees. In Amendment 3, we were talking about royalties being directed toward this fund. Does Amendment 2 allow the legislature to dedicate royalties to the education fund?
Ms. Marks?
Yeah, Marie Marks, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Representative Bynum. Yes, if the legislature in the future has a major gas pipeline project and wishes to appropriate those royalties, they could appropriate those royalties if instead they establish a dedication of revenue by law. Then the Amendment 2 that passed would allow that dedication of revenue directly into the education fund if that is the will of the legislature.
Okay, thank you. With that, I'll withdraw my objection. Thank you.
Object.
Representative Ballard, would you like to speak to your objection?
Yeah, I have some notes here if you don't mind.
So I have a little bit of concern in regards to the dedicated funds and reduce the legislature's flexibility under our last constitutional structure. And the prohibition of dedicated funds exists precisely to preserve broad legislative discretion over the budget. I also have concerns about the Constitution and its structure to get the legislature near total budget authority, which is unusual in most states. This would take that away, so it's concerning to me. And, I just keep my objection there. Thank you.
For the discussion, seeing none, the objection is maintained, and this is for the amendment to, the motion to move the bill from committee. Madam Clerk, if you could please call the roll.
Representative Jimmy.
Yes.
Representative Bynum.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
Yes.
Representative Moore.
No.
Representative Allard.
No.
Representative Hannon.
Yes.
Representative Tomaszewski. Representative Galvin.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Schrage.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
8 yay, 3 nay.
Vote of 8 yay to 3 nay. Senate Joint Resolution 29, which is version 34-LS1570/A, moves out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Mr. Gruen, Grusendorf, any final words before we take a brief at ease?
Through the chair, I just want to thank you, the finance members, for hearing this bill and putting some time into it. And I think the bill is a better bill coming out of committee. Thank
Great.
You.
Okay, thank you very much. So if we could pass out the committee report and have everyone sign that, and then we'll switch over to the next bill. And so we'll take a brief at ease. Brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 4:21 p.m. And before us is Senate Bill 86. That is the Money Transmission and Virtual Currency Bill. I'd like to invite up Senator Keel as well as his staff, Ms. Aurora Hawk. If you could please put yourselves on the record. Give us a recap of the bill, and then we'll move into the five amendments that we have for the bill. So with that, welcome back, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and members of the House Finance Committee. For your records, I am Jesse Keel, and I get to be the senator for Senate District B. With me is Aurora Hawk of my staff. we'll try the short recap and see if members need more detail. This bill is sometimes called the Money Services Business Modernization Act. It updates and modernizes Alaska's money services licensees or license laws, so that's money transmitters, currency exchangers, to a Conference of State Bank Supervisors model that was collaboratively worked out with bank examiners from red states, blue states, purple states, and industry, all at the table. It updates Alaska's laws to this new model, which is more efficient, more effective, and definitely better written for the modern day of electronic money transmission rather than our previous laws, which were all written before there was such a thing as Venmo. The bill also includes virtual currency. So most of us think of cryptocurrency. Under that framework, it assures basic safety and soundness protections for Alaskans. No crooks at corporate, no diverting the customer's asset, no using the customer's assets to settle a bankruptcy debt of the company, and then some other very rudimentary protections, receipts, disclosures, and having cash or crypto to cover what Alaskans have entrusted to the company to transmit. It is, Mr. Chairman, a modernization of our regulations. It is not a significant expansion of our regulations. We don't get into what risks an Alaskan may take or what assets they may hold. We make sure that when it's held for them, the company is doing that right.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. So with that, the first amendment is by myself, so I'm going to move amendment number one. If anyone would like to
object just for a brief explanation.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Stapp. Mr. Anderson, if you could come up and explain amendment number one. And while I've got a moment, I just want to also recognize that we have in the audience with us Representative Garrett Nelson. Thank you for joining us today. Oh. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster. Before the committee today is amendment number one. This is the effective date changes. When this bill was first drafted last year, the effective dates were designed for the passage of a bill in the standing year. The fact that this bill has come over to the second session, the effective dates have been switched over to remain consistent with the intent of the bill, but now is designed to go into effect after the passage of the bill, if this bill would be to pass by the end of this session.
Okay. Senator Keel, any comments on this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a welcome amendment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments or questions on amendment number one?
I withdraw my objection.
The objection is withdrawn. I don't see any further objections. So with that, amendment number one to the bill, SB 86, has been adopted. That takes us to amendment number two, and that's by Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I move amendment two.
I'll object for purpose of discussion, Representative Stapp.
Okay, so this is going to be first in a series of kind of amendments, kind of a little challenging bill, but I would consider this to be a bit of a cleanup amendment, Mr. Co-Chair. So the bill requires licensed money transmitters to maintain sufficient assets to back the currency in your control and list permissible investments. What the amendment does, it just clarifies virtual currency is the only permissible investments for assets backing virtual currency. And it also addresses one concern that was outlined in a letter in the bill packet from AgPERG back in January 2026.
Okay, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a good amendment and a welcome cleanup. The underlying notion of the bill is that a licensee needs to have cash or safe investments to cover cash and needs to have the crypto to cover crypto. This makes sure that crypto doesn't cover cash. In theory, I suppose a company could cover crypto assets with cash if they wanted to, but that's very safe. So this works very well and is an excellent clarification, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I'm going to remove my objection. Is there any further objection on Amendment Number 2? Seeing none, Amendment Number 2 has been adopted. Representative Stapp, you have Amendment Number 3.
I move Amendment 3.
Okay, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Stapp.
Okay, Amendment 3, another I consider cleanup amendment. It's relatively simple. Basically closes a potential regulatory gap between federal and state law that potentially governs virtual currency activity that could be allow some entities to escape from regulation by convincing the state that they're governed under the federal code as the feds when they're actuality under the state code. So the amendment just goes into page 11, lines 26 through 31, and deletes some of those provisions, and also addresses another concern outlined in the bill packet, which I believe was also raised by AgPERT, but I'd have to go back and check my my letter. The sponsors are nodding yes, so I think it was addressed by AgPERT.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Representative bringing this amendment forward. It does just what he says. The bill is built around a one regulator model, so we're not double regulating anyone. The way this functions, it keeps a licensee from potentially saying, you can't regulate me, they do, and telling the other side, you can't regulate me, they do. This works to make sure nobody slips through. So an excellent change, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I just have one quick question. My understanding is that the virtual currency licensees can include virtual currency in their calculation of their tangible net worth. Does that have any implications for what we heard in Amendment 2, or is it does it align with that? Amendment 2, where we heard from Representative Stapp that they must let's see, what was I reading? It was that you had to have enough of that particular currency in order to you have to have sufficient quantity of the virtual currency to satisfy the aggregate entitlements. And again, this is all very fuzzy to me. I just wanted to make sure that it's not incongruent, if you will.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. neither Amendment 2 nor Amendment 3 changes the way that tangible net worth would be calculated.
Okay.
And so I think they both maintain that rudimentary security element so that a licensee must have that minimum net worth. It's a relatively low net worth, so it's not to be a barrier to entry for new companies, new businesses in Alaska. But this amendment, and like the one before it, does not change how tangible net worth is calculated.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I don't see any further questions. I'm going to remove my objection to Amendment Number 3, unless you had any comments, Representative Stapp. Okay, I remove my objection. Any further objections on Amendment Number 3? Hearing none, Amendment Number 3 has been adopted. That takes us to Amendment Number 4, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move Amendment 4.
Okay, and I'll object, Representative Stapp.
Okay, this one is a little bit more than a cleanup amendment. Basically, this amendment removes the blanket exemption for payroll processing companies and instead gives the department authority to exempt small payroll processing companies by regulation. And when you kind of think about the notions of cryptocurrency and how to utilize that, initially a wide blanket exemption for payroll processors kind of highlighted the ability that you might have some sort of loophole. So in discussing with the sponsor, and if you read the letter in the packet from the National Payroll Reporting Consortium, they probably should be included because of the nature of payroll and how sensitive it is. And really, fraud in the payroll industry is real. I mean, there's been plenty of examples, I think, in our thing. And I just kind of view this as a kind of a consumer protection amendment, but certainly defer to the sponsor if he has any questions.
Okay, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree both with the characterization of the amendment and what the amendment does. So this will prevent your mom and pop, so to speak, a small bookkeeper or perhaps a local small Alaskan CPA firm that does payroll processing as part of its work from needing to get licensed as though it were a money services business. However, there are some very large payroll processors, nationally known names, companies that release national economic data. And the volume of money that they transmit or value that they transmit, I think justifies licensing them under the bill. And to be clear, my understanding that some of those companies would like to be licensed as money transmitters in Alaska. So this would allow for that. They would not have a blanket exemption, but the division could exempt your small mom and pops, your small Alaska CPA firm.
Okay. Representative Galvin?
No.
Okay. Representative Josephson?
Yes, through the chair. Senator Keel, this sounds like you're supportive of this amendment.
Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson is correct. This is a good amendment. It was worked out in compromise with the large payroll processors, the division, my office. I thank the representative for his work.
Quick comment,
Representative Josephson?
Only that I wish my whole life would work the way these first four amendments do.
You and me both, Mr. Co-Chairman.
Representative Allard?
Thank you. And just to add on to that, I just looked up my colleague and I had a whole bunch of no's. No offense, of why I wouldn't be able to do this. And yeah, these amendments just kind of clarify. I appreciate you working with the House here on that and him will bringing it forward. Thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Stepp, do you need to wrap up? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and remove my objection. Seeing no further objections, amendment number 4 has been adopted. And so we have two other amendments. It's 5 and 6. Representative Staff.
Ms. Co-Chair, I move amendment 5.
Okay, I'll object. Representative Staff.
Okay, so again, complicated bill, Mr. Co-Chair. This amendment number 5 basically starts with deleting this section on page 38, line 23 through 25. Basically, the amendment separates civil penalties into two parts to insulate the much-needed increase in civil penalties from the two-thirds vote required to pass the indirect court rule amendment allowed for the collection of investigation fees. I've run across this indirect court amendment a few times. I find it pesky, but framers wrote it that way for a reason, I suppose. So this basically allows us not to kind of have to deal with that. And I could be happy to go in more detail.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The members of the committee may recall in hearing a different version of this bill last year, this issue came up. And in working with the maker of the amendment, I think this cleans it up. With this change, the provisions of the bill and how it works stay the same. The indirect court rule amendment is limited only to that which would require a change in the court's rules. The other piece didn't actually need to be tied to a two-thirds vote. And so I consider this a tidy-up amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I thank the offer of the amendment. I support it.
Okay, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, and to the maker of the amendment. I'm just looking at the not to exceed 10,000 that were, I guess, how much could extra civil penalties fees potentially add up to on top of the 10,000 cap?
Representative Stout.
I think Co-Chair Foster threw the chair to Representative Galvin. I think the previous version was $1,000 in the penalty, and we could increase that to $10,000. I don't know if the penalties stack or not.
That's what I wondered. Okay.
Yeah, and that does not require, as the sponsor said, the nature of the court rule to do that. So that's kind of why they looked at that. Through the chair.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to Representative Galvin's question, the $10,000 now matches what is in law for bad actions by mortgage licensees. So this is parity. It is separate from the department's ability to recover its costs and expenses for investigating and prosecuting. So they would, in fact, be separate amounts.
Okay. Any further discussion on amendment number five? Seeing none, wrap up, Representative Staff?
No wrap.
Okay, I'm going to remove my objection. Any further objection? Seeing none, amendment number five has been adopted. That takes us to the last amendment, which is amendment number six, Representative Staff.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move amendment number six.
Object.
Okay, I think this is super efficient finance committee amendment time. So amendment six, basically the amendment ensures that virtual currency is covered for unclaimed property, I'm covered by unclaimed property laws, which prevents companies from having to hold assets in perpetuity and also helps connect individuals who with their own long loss funds. So I encourage everyone to look themselves up on the unclaimed property database. I have done that myself. The 2 days before I went to Iraq, I got a speeding ticket and I overpaid the Alaska State Troopers. And if you go on unclaimed property, you will still find that I have not collected that unclaimed property, just so I could tell the story at the House Finance Committee, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Do we have any discussion on amendment number six? Okay. Seeing no discussion, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This issue was brought to our attention by some folks some businesses that would be licensees or will be licensees, and they pointed out some ways in which Alaska's current unclaimed property laws don't fit well with virtual currencies. And so the amendment is intended to clarify that and to make those laws work well, so that if an Alaskan is separated for some significant period of time from their account, from their assets, and the licensee cannot find the Alaskan, then the asset can go to unclaimed property. So it's a good amendment, Mr. Chairman, and it was worked out in conjunction with my office. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any wrap-up, Representative Stapp?
No wrap-up. Just make sure you check the unclaimed property website.
Okay. With that, I'm going to remove my objection. I see no further objections. So with that, amendment number six has been adopted. That takes us through the entirety of the amendment process. And if it is the will of the committee, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee. Representative Shragi.
Yes, Co-Chair Foster. I move Senate Bill 86, Work Order 34-LS0305/O, out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, hearing no objection. SB 86, which is version 34-LS0305/O, moves out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And so, Senator Keel, any parting words?
Mr. Chairman, my thanks to you and to the committee for putting now three meetings of effort into this bill and for the cleanup. Great work was done today, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. So, Representative Ballard.
Thank you. And I apologize. I should have given you the last word. But it's really nice, Senator, to see someone from the other body come and actually have buy-in with us members here in finance. Not that they don't. It was just a really good, and you worked with us, and it just allows us to say yes. So thank you for bringing that forward.
And Representative
Biden. Chairman, there's a first time for everything.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just thank you, Senator Keel, for bringing this forward. And if you would leave your review of the House Finance Committee,
yes.
We appreciate that. Thank you.
I'll like and subscribe. Good,
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just so you guys know, I have to work with him. So he is my senator. So thank you for all of that. They all love you. Thank you very much, Senator. They never say this to any of the other senators. Now I'm never going to hear the end of it. Because we have weekly delegation meetings, and I'm sure this is going to come up.
Senator Keel, you're a good guy. Thank you for being here. Okay, so with that, we are going to jump right into the next bill. And we're shooting to be out of here by about 5, so that gives us about 20 minutes. But I think the actual voting part is is over. And so if folks need to leave a little early and some of us are able to stay a little later, I'm willing to do that. So with that, our next bill is House Bill 104. And I'd like to invite up Representative Mears as well as her staff, Talia Eames, if you'd like to come up, put yourselves on the record, and reintroduce this bill. Looks like we last heard it on May 17 and May 18. We had public testimony on May 17. And so we may need to get more of an in-depth recap of the bill. And so with that, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and members of the House Finance Committee. I am Representative Donna Mears, representing the fine folks in South Muldoon, House District 21. I'm grateful for the timing and your appreciation of Senator Keel, as House Bill 104 is a companion to a bill he's carrying over on the Senate side, and it is in their Finance Committee at the moment. House Bill 104 is address confidentiality. There's a small but important group of people in the state that have reasons to keep their addresses out of the public record. This includes peace officers and correctional officers who may be targets of retribution due to their roles in the justice system. It also includes victims of domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault, and other people who have got protective orders and safety plans. The purpose of a program like this is to allow someone who faces these serious threats to be able to participate fully in everyday daily life without further endangering themselves or their family. House Bill 104 creates an address protection program for survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence, peace officers and correctional officers, and their families. There are many times an address must be provided in order to participate in society, and these include voting, working, sending children to school, and more. HB 104 establishes a program whereby these at-risk individuals can receive mail at a centralized anonymized P.O. box. Mail received by the state on behalf of enrollees will then be forwarded to the participant's home address, which will remain confidential under penalty of law. So I wanted to really be thankful that we've got folks that can speak about these programs in other states. We've got Keely Olson on the line. What I think where we need to go with our discussion today is we have a relatively significant fiscal note on this bill. And I'd like, if it's the committee's will, to have a discussion about getting a little deeper into how many people would actually potentially be able to utilize this program. Having your mail that is associated with a legal address for these purposes is not convenient. This program is designed for folks that are doing other extraordinary measures to keep themselves protected from stalkers and people that are coming after them. So we really are looking at a small number of people. And as we go through our work here, yes, it's as we try and figure out how many people could be involved. So looking at all, you know, peace officers and corrections officers and the number of people with protective orders or could be in there is a universe to look at. But the reality is that a very small number of folks are going to be able to utilize this program. If it's the will of the committee, if Ms. Keely Olson is available to give us a little background and share her experience with programs from other states and the actual utilization of similar programs.
Okay, we'll go to Ms. Keely Olson. If you're online, it looks like you're calling in from Anchorage. If you can just state your name and your affiliation.
Good afternoon. Thank you to the chair and the committee. For the record, my name is Keely Olson, and I'm the executive director for STAR in Anchorage.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 104. I consider it a critical piece of legislation and would welcome an address confidentiality program in Alaska. Prior to working at STAR, I worked as a victim advocate in a couple of other states, Washington State and the state of Montana, both of which had address confidentiality programs. They provided essential tools for advocates to assist someone that was being faced with stalking or a case of domestic violence or sexual assault with high lethality risk to help them be safer. Combined with comprehensive safety planning and an emergency relocation plan, address confidentiality programs can help save lives and help survivors cope with the constant fear of their location being compromised. Address confidentiality programs are available in more than 40 states. Alaska is one of a handful of states that does not offer this kind of protection, while at the same time we have the highest incidence of men committing homicide against women in the state of Alaska. So any kind of protection that we can offer to people who are doing their darndest to get safe and following a ton of procedures to do so, I think it behooves us and actually would save state dollars moving forward in law enforcement response alone. The programs that I have experience with are accessible, easy to use, and inexpensive. Last year, out of curiosity, I contacted Montana's program administrator to ask about their program that is run out of their Secretary of State's office. It began in 2006, and over the last 17 years, now 18 years, that I was talking with them a year ago, in April of 2025, they informed me that the program had cost Montana around $22,000 a year to operate. They had 68 participants enrolled. Many of those were not actively using the program. The main costs of the program were to pay a small portion of an administrator's salary and her assistant's salary for dealing with very part-time types of response for taking someone's, first-class mail and forwarding it on to a protected address. I applaud making the program accessible to law enforcement. I have worked with those in law enforcement who have placed their homes in a spouse or family member's name to protect their addresses, all at incredible risk to themselves, in case of a falling out, as it were. So I can appreciate the need for their inclusion in this bill and would support it. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and would be available for any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Does the committee have any questions? And I saw Representative Allard earlier. Did you have
a sponsor?
Okay, so I had Representative Allard, then Josephson, or I guess to this. First, let's go to the sponsor, and then we'll go to the committee. Actually, let's back up. I think this question is, we're going to go to Representative Allard, sorry.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay, I got you, co-chair. Okay, so I have a couple questions. We did say police officers, and we said law enforcement are not law enforcement. Maybe we did. And then, so my question would be through the chair to Representative Mears, when you say peace officers, what does that include besides correctional officers and possibly just police officers?
Representative Mears.
Representative Allard, I was also speaking, off the riff. I'm sure there's a definition in here, but last year, I don't know if you recall, we did have
I have bad memory. That's why I'm trying to get familiar with it.
I reviewed myself through the chair to Representative Allard from Chief Boss here in Juneau. So law enforcement officers.
Say that again.
Law enforcement officers.
Is that federal?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, in the package, we have peace officer means an officer of the state troopers, a member of police force of a municipality, a village public safety officer, a regional public safety officer, a United States marshal or deputy marshal, and an officer whose duty is to enforce and preserve the public peace.
Okay.
And if I could just clarify, that was Representative Mears, and I think it's maybe a little difficult for the folks in the back to try to keep a record here. Want to make sure we're – Representative Allard.
Thank you, and through the co-chair. Thank you for that. So that's the definition that you came up with for the bill?
Representative Mears.
Representative Mears, for the record, through the chair to Representative Allard, that is in statute already, AS01.10.060.
Thank you, through the co-chair. I'm just going to cut through the chase. Does that include ICE?
Representative Mears.
Representative Mears through the chair to Representative Allard. I am not extremely familiar with all the definitions, but that does not appear to be included in our current definitions.
Okay. Thank you. And may I?
Representative Allard.
Thank you. And thank you for being here, Representative Mears. What about predators? What about individuals who have been convicted of really bad crimes, whether it's on children or women or other men, and they're on a register? How, and say like they've been, I think we talked about it a little bit last year, and that somebody's threatened them or they've been stalked. How are we going to still say, I mean, I don't think they deserve it, but protect them so that their address may be not disclosed, but I would like to know where they're at in case my granddaughter one day drives her, rides her little bike by their house.
Representative Mears.
Representative Mears through the chair to Representative Allard. My recollection from Chief Boss's testimony last year was no, it does not include those folks. This is looking for people that meet that definition of a peace officer, okay, corrections officer, or folks with protective orders or safety plans for domestic violence.
So they wouldn't fall under that. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair. Okay. Thank you.
That was Representative Allard. Just so folks know, I do have an extensive queue here. I've got Representative Josephson, Galvin, Bynum, Hannon. Yeah, okay. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the bill, Representative Mears. Representative Mears, was there any beneath this committee or earlier committee, was there any request that judicial officers be added?
Representative Mears.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, it has been discussed both in State Affairs and briefly here as well last year in Finance, I believe. The answer was no, there had not been a request from those folks.
Okay.
Representative Josephson.
Are you, and we have Mr. Anderson who briefs us on our options, but are you finding the principal fiscal note number 2333 with all the dollars, are you finding that sort of not agreeable to you? That is, are you thinking it's embellished or the cost is exaggerated or something like that?
Representative Mears.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I think when we look at numbers, we need to look at quantity and what's included in them. I think that the number of folks that are included in the fiscal note is larger than one would expect. The amount of folks, particularly for corrections officers and peace officers, really would be a very limited number. And I believe the fiscal note includes quite a large number of them. And then also a line of question Representative Hannon had last year was about the amount of support someone falling in that category might need to utilize the program. And when you look at those two things in consideration of the amount per person for being spent in other states for this program, the per person in other states is much smaller than is represented. So the quantity and the per unit cost in this fiscal note are significantly more than we're seeing in other places. Ms. Ames also has a comment on that.
Ms. Ames?
Through the chair, for the record, Talia Ames. We also did some math last year with the state of Washington's program. Washington has a significantly larger population. And in 2021, which is the most recent record we had, they had about 5,000 people in their address confidentiality program for a total of $766,000 divided by the number of participants. That's about $153 per enrollee for the state of Washington. If we use a similar calculation with Alaska, with the fiscal note of 423,000 and 650 participants, it would be $650 per enrollee, which is significantly higher than the existing program in Washington of 153.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Next question I've got, Representative Galvin. Did you have a...
No, that was asked just okay. Now. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bynum, then Hannon. Representative Bynum.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Representative Mears, thank you for bringing this forward. You know, on its surface, when I look at this bill, I was trying to think about it, and I recalled back to last year, and it came back to me, you know, some of my, I guess, objections to the bill, not the concept, but the bill itself. And that was, you know, the expansive scope of who's covered and how we're developing a system within the state government to actually implement this. And I think last year, and correct me if I'm wrong, when I asked the question of whether or not their service is already providing these services, I believe the answer was yes. Is that accurate? And when I say other services, people providing services, I don't mean the state government. I mean third-party vendors in the private market that would provide these types of services.
Representative Mears?
For the record, Representative Mears, through the co-chair to Representative Bynum, there are some services that you can anonymize your address, but there are other things that you are required to provide a legal address for. So you can so one of the provisions of the bill is that it's allowed to use this PO box for registering a child for school, for example, which you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. So you can tick a box, I know, in the municipality of Anchorage of, no, I don't want my address published here. So there are some of those protections, but this is above and beyond, so that this anonymized address is illegal for address for the folks in the program. Sure. So there are other ways, but these are the last final steps to help protect people's safety.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Mears, thank you for that. And so then the thought then for me goes to the idea of that what I would like, this is just my personal perspective on this, is what I'd like to be able to see happen is that we would put into law that people that are meeting certain categories can use these other services. And then instead of us developing a full program to provide the actual service, if we feel that it's needed, that we provide grants or funding through organizations that are already helping with this. I can think of quite a few back home. WISH is one of those, Women in Safe Homes, that specifically helps address victims of violence and helping them navigate these things. So I really applaud the concept behind the bill. I just don't know that I'm in favor of actually creating a whole department or a governmental component to actually implement such a program, but I would support an element within law that would allow those addresses provided through services to be acceptable forms of address for the purposes of governmental activity. So those are my thoughts.
We're going to go to the next two questions, then we'll close it out for the day. And I've got Representative Galvin and Hannon. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I wondered if I could ask the testifier from STAR a quick question.
Sure.
If she's available. Mm-hmm. Ms. Keeley, Ms. Olson, I should say, thank you for being here. I'm curious to know, since you've been participatory of this sort of a program in Washington and in Montana, are the folks who are needing or wanting this level, this extra layer of protection, do they have the resources to pay for their own post office box? How was that done? Or how was that experienced in the states that you've worked in?
Ms. Olson was online a second ago, but I think she might be off now. If I could just verify, okay, off, not online, okay.
Perhaps the sponsor could help us with knowing. It seems like this has been done before, and these likely are the sorts of folks who don't have a lot of extra resources, but I just don't know, and I wanted to hear if that's something you would like to share with us.
Ms. Ames.
Through the co-chair to Representative Galvin. I think often when people are in this level of needing protection, they're fleeing violence, they've relocated several times, they often don't have the resources. They are very much in survival mode. securing a post office box or a mail forwarding service might be the last thing on their minds. A lot of times when people are fleeing violence, they also don't have a lot of money. You know, a lot of things happen with domestic violence, and one of those things is economic control. So I would go out and say that a lot of them, most of them likely do not have the resources to take this upon themselves or the focus on that, those things.
Okay. Thank you. And I have one more follow-up to the sponsor too, or staff. When we hear that you can check off a box in terms of not having your address published through a municipal form, is that the same thing as getting a post office box that is specific to any mail that you need to be sent to you?
Representative Mears?
For the record, Donna Mears, through the chair to Representative Galvin, I think there's a number of different layers and opportunities for privacy and what is readily available on public records. So my example of municipal property tax records is you can go and you can look up a property and see who the property owner is and get an address. So that can be anonymized through that process there. Being able to have a post office box instead of using your personal address for a number of things is another layer of, you know, being able to provide privacy to yourself. But where this bill goes is there's another level of things that folks need a real physical address for that might be in an unsecured system, that this allows to happen. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's a number of things that you can do, but this takes those final steps to protect people that are being stalked.
Okay, thank you. And I was going to ask also about the $22,000 of Ms. Olson, when it's 8.12 million people who live in Washington, whereas here we only have 700,000. So I just can't imagine that this fiscal note is anywhere near what we could do. I can't piece that together. So to me, that's something I would enjoy hearing from someone who knows more about how other states have done it so economically, because clearly there's a disconnect here. And I don't want one woman or man who is feeling unprotected to not have this opportunity because we've somehow been unaccustomed to this. And so we inflated this fiscal note perhaps in ways that was being careful. I just really think that we need to be mindful that, you know, it's our job to help do everything we can to, especially at this level of security that's needed, bring this on. So I'm not sure how to address that, co-chair, but I did hear in the past that your staff gave us some suggestions around fiscal notes. I just wouldn't know how to approach it. And I'm open to that, though, because this feels very important. Thank you.
Maybe Representative Mears, we certainly want to try to use good data when we and we try not to change fiscal notes whenever possible. But in extraordinary circumstances, when the committee feels that it's necessary, I think it's justified as long as we've got good data for that. So maybe that's something that we can look into some more with my staff and Representative Mears. I do have two additional questions, and then we are going to close out. So Representative Hannon and Josephson. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Actually, mine were comments, and I wish a couple of the members who asked these questions were still here, because I took fairly extensive notes on my draft last May, or not my draft, the bill when we first heard it, including the carve out on page 3. Representative Allard asked about, she didn't use the words, but she was talking about people who might be subject to the sex offender registry. The bill on page 3, lines 10 and 11, subsection D, calls out a carve out that AS 1263010, which is the sex offender registry. So if you are a subject of the sex offender registry, you are not eligible for this confidentiality carve out. I think when Representative Bynum was talking about other programs that may give you some processes to be anonymous, I think the reason this bill is important is this places it in statute, because most of those are programs and services of private companies that say, you know, we can do mail forwarding, et cetera, many of them designed around corporations and LLCs. But this places in statute similar to, in my mind, HIPAA violation. If you are a part of this, there is a legal ramification for violating the confidentiality that it places in statute. And then third, my recollection of our fiscal note being large is the first category of people who've been subject to stalking or domestic violence spells out very specific parameters of you need to have an ongoing stalking order. It needs to be for multiple years. You could be the child of that. But then when we go to peace officer and corrections officer, there are no other qualifiers. And my recollection is that the fiscal notes were predicated on a substantial portion of those people who just by definition are peace officers are going to take advantage of this. But I'm going to assert, if we go back to how this works and the kinds of inconveniences it throws in your way, that most peace officers, especially in a town where they know that because they're the baseball coach, that their neighbors know they're a cop, they're not going to try and hide their identity because their cop car comes home and parks in their driveway every night. So even though mathematically it's eligible to be, the fact is that most peace officers and correction officers in our communities aren't going to, unless they've been under threat, but then they're going to have taken other means to try and already exercise where there is some option to not use your real and ongoing legal address. So I don't want to say that the department's overblowing it, but they don't know how many people, because the category of peace officers and correction officers say anyone who is a member of that category could. So they've got to anticipate that perhaps a lot of them will. But I think in small towns, I think there'd be few, because people are already known to you who the police officer are who works at corrections. Now, that's going to be a little different in Anchorage, maybe Fairbanks. But in Seward, where our largest maximum security prison is, everybody knows who works at the prison because those are good jobs. Right. So those are my thoughts, and I do support the bill. And my recollection is I do think the judicial officers may have gotten more stalking threats, but they haven't necessarily asked to be included.
I think we're getting more questions. Yes. I might just
a comment.
Gavel us out here and then bring up questions. I guess we'll finish off then. Representative Josephson and Bynum.
Well, between 2003 and 12, I did strictly family law and frequent protective order hearings, defending them or defending my clients who were respondents or petitioners. And typically when you're filling out the form, it says, where do you want the respondent to not go? And, you know, you have to, the judge has to say, you can't go to 123 Maple Street, because otherwise the guy doesn't know he can't go there. If it's really well anonymized, and he's not stalking or pursuing the person, then I guess you don't need that. So typically the protective order would say, don't go to their workplace at 123, you know, Turnkey Street, and don't go to their home at 123 Maple Street, and don't call them at 907, you know, 111-2222. And that person would be subject to a type A misdemeanor. So I don't know. It's just a wrinkle to think about, and I don't know if you have a comment.
I hate to get too far into this conversation without when we're missing about half of our committee, and so, but Representative Mears, and then hopefully our last comment will be Representative Bynum, and then we can try to include the rest of our committee at our next meeting. So, Representative Mears,
thank you, Representative Mears, through the chair to Representative Josephson. I think there's a lot of complexities that people are dealing with when they're in these situations, and the folks that are helping support them advocate are making sure that they're privacy is being held, however it needs to be. I am not deep into the specifics of all those other circumstances and how to get there. Circumstances vary, and we know that this is something that, if enacted in statute, will help protect that last bit for folks that are on the run and moving. Ms. Ames has a comment on this as well.
Ms. Ames.
Through the chair, Talia Ames, for the record, to Representative Josephson. On page 3, line 3, B, the victim meets other standards set by the department. That was asked to be put in by the network for the purpose of those that might not be able to get a protective order for some of the reasons you say, so they don't have to disclose locations, because sometimes in a safety plan, a protective order is not always the best thing for a victim of domestic violence or stalking. So that would cover people that do not have those protective orders.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I just wanted to clarify for the record that I am in favor of putting into law non-disclosure components or tools that the state would have available to people that are impacted by these particular issues. But what I was trying to say is that I'm not in favor of, I'm not in favor of creating a state agency or the state becoming a mail forwarding provider. And I think that you can have both, or that you can get both results without the state providing basically mail forwarding services. But I am fully in favor of putting in law the non-disclosure tools necessary to protect victims of violence. And I know that that's complex because there's lots of different places where we might need to do that. PFD applications, DMV, court records, other garnishments and other things that might be required. So I know that's complex. I do support putting non-disclosure in law. It's just the mail forwarding component that I would just have some issues with. So I just want to clarify that on the record.
Okay, thank you. Like I say, I kind of wish, I think for the reason Representative Hannon mentioned earlier, just trying to have some more of our fellow finance members here. I think a number of good points have just been made, and so hopefully maybe they can go back and watch maybe this last 15 minutes of the committee meeting. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and make an announcement for our next meeting. Thank you very much, Representative Mears and Ms. Ames, for being here. And we did send out a email earlier and setting 2 amendment deadlines. And just to reiterate those here, that was Senate Bill 130. That's the Fisheries Production Development Tax Credit. We're going to set that for Wednesday, May 6th at 5 p.m. And then House Bill 195, that is the pharmacist bill, the pharmacist prescriptive authority for that'll be set for Thursday, May 7th at noon. And so with that, our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And at that meeting, we'll hear introductions on Senate Bill 29. That's the Big Game Commercial Services Board bill, as well as House Bill 388. That's the bulk fuel loan cap bill. And so if there's nothing else to come before the committee, Representative Bynum?
Co-Chair Foster, I just want to say I think my other colleagues have left to a meeting that I'm currently missing. So I just wanted to put it on the record. I believe that that's what happened, is that they had another meeting scheduled at 5 and they left for that. And unfortunately, I'm being here. So
you get to bring back the
news.
The good word. There you go. Yes, you're the representative of the representatives.
Thank you, sir.
So with that, House Finance will be adjourned at 5:15 p.m. Thank you.